find parking and got their favorite seat. So.
So take it away, Mitch.
Everyone's still there, or did I just?
Nope, we're all here. And I just wanted to let people know we're going to record today's session. I hope that works for you. And Mitch, take it away.
Okay. So welcome, everyone. It's exciting for us. This is our largest turnout for an event. So thank you to Jack for, the book he wrote and offering his thoughts today. I have the very easy job as the president of our Ottawa CAGP chapter of introducing our two speakers. And it was interesting, as I was having to look at Jack's bio and Jenny, who will be our moderator today. They're two people who I know well and very impressed also with everything I was able to read about them in their bio, which, to be honest with you, all of you can read on their websites. But what I find most impressive, and I was talking to another colleague today who works in fundraising and long-term care, which I'm in, is the community that we're in, all of us who are here today as fundraisers, how we all happen to work together. You know, when I was describing him, Jack's experience and why he should be on the call today, and how Jack is also doing consulting now, and how Jenny does consulting, and they're on this call together to help all of us learn more and to do more good work for the charities we happen to represent. It's a great family of fundraisers. So I'm not going to go through their bios. You're here, you know them a bit. You can certainly go on their websites. And I'm going to be turning it over to Jack in one moment. But first, I just wanted to let everyone know who had registered before the deadline that we were going to be doing a draw for one copy of Jack's book. And that went to Megan Mack at Carleton. I don't know, is Megan on the call today? So I'll make sure that this gets out to Megan. And we will be doing another draw. Jack challenged us that if attendance was high and we hit that mark, that he'd offer us a second book. So we're going to do a second draw at the end of the session, which you just have to be here for. So on that, I will turn it over to Jack and Jenny.
Thanks.
All right, well, I'm not gonna say much except I am the moderator. So if you have questions, Jack's gracefully said he's happy to answer questions along the way, and I'll be keeping track of the chat and feeding them over to Jack. So Jack, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us more. I can't wait to talk more about the trenches.
Yeah, so I've been in the fundraising world for a little over 25 years, only seems like about 100 to me, but I figured that what I would do is kind of give some anecdotes over the years, kind of my best practices, what I've learned over the years. The first thing I learned is the word campaign has a really special term, and it's only used in a couple occasions. It's used in politics, it's used in war, and it's used in fundraising/marketing. That's it. So, it's an interesting thing. So one of the things that I said that I would chat about was dispelling myths, because, most people aren't fundraisers from the get-go, though I have to say I am. I started fundraising as a volunteer. I grew up in London, Ontario, and the Canadian Cancer Society entrusted the high school students to do their door-to-door canvassing in April for Cancer Month. So my motives were less than altruistic. It was a great way to get out of class. And in those early 80s, I got a crisp $100 bill, which in those days was huge money. I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. Loved it. So I wound up staying. I went to Western as for my university studies. And I stayed on as the vice chairman of the residential campaign for the Canadian Cancer Society. After I graduated university, I moved to Denver for a couple of years. I worked for a nonprofit there. Came back here to get married. My buddy who was at the Canadian Cancer Society said he had a friend of his who was opening up a consulting firm in Burlington, a fundraising consulting firm, thought I would be good at it. And as the good Jewish boy, my specialty were Catholic churches and Unitarian churches. So I did that for a while. We saw, I was a dual citizen, so I wound up doing a lot of work in the States as well as in Canada, which didn't make for a great first year of marriage, where I'd kind of say goodbye on Mondays and see you again on Fridays. So we were looking for something else, and many moons later, Carlton was looking for a fundraiser. It was relatively short-lived. I think I lasted a whopping 12 weeks there. As I was headhunted to go join the brand new Ottawa Hospital Foundation, the merger of the Civic, Riverside, and General. Lasted there for a while, and was poached to head up the Ottawa Jewish Community Foundation and the Jewish Federation of Ottawa. So think of United Way, just Jewish, and Ottawa Community Foundation, just Jewish. Did that, and then I was at the Y for about 8.5 years. So I've done fundraising, and I've kind of seen things come and go and ebb and flow as it is, but I'm one of the few folks that has actually been in fundraising my whole career, as opposed to most folks who kind of fall into it or they do it off the side of their desk. So one of the things that I find is kind of a pet peeve are some myths that people believe about fundraising. So in my book, I go through 10. I'm not going to go through all 10 here because otherwise you would never buy the book. So I'm going to go through 5 of them that are there. And one of them that I was actually chatting with Jenny earlier is people think, oh, most money comes from events. No. Now, I know some of you guys that are here are very heavy into events, but the reality is most money does not come from events. And most money comes from either a major gift or actually a planned gift. Actually, I hate that phrase, planned giving. Like, what's the opposite of it? Impulse giving? You know, aside from the fact that when your next door neighbor comes and canvasses for something and you give them money because you don't want to look like a heel, any gift is a planned gift. So I would much prefer bequest giving or deferred giving or something like that. But planned giving is actually a horrible, horrible phrase in my mind. So, you know, obviously there's different revenue streams. There's, you know, your events, there's your major gifts, there's your direct mail. And bequests tend to be kind of like the holy grail in the fundraising world. And the problem with bequests is that it's hard to budget for them and it's hard to realize what's going to happen. So, you know, I know that I instituted a plan when I was at the Ottawa Hospital. We did a 5-year rolling average of what we would get in bequests because A, you have no control over who dies when, as much as some of you may think that you do. And B, you have no control what 4% of an estate is worth. You have no idea. So, you know, some years you're going to do absolutely amazing and some years you're not going to do so amazing. But if you take a 5-year rolling average, it tends to kind of even out in the wash. But it's really, really hard to budget for. The reality is the work that people do in securing these bequests is there's about a 10-year lag between the work you do today and the bequest that you're eventually going to receive and the organization is eventually going to receive. And it's really hard for what I call boards and bosses to evaluate that, right? If you run a golf tournament, it's really easy to take a look and see, well, this is how much we raised. Either money's there or it isn't. And this is the effort that was there and either the money's there or it isn't. Major gifts take a little bit longer, but, you know, talk about a 2-year horizon. You kind of know within 2 years whether you're going to be getting a decent gift. Bequests are a totally different animal. It's usually a 10-year lag in between what you do now and the bequest that your organization is eventually going to receive. So that's kind of the first myth is that, you know, events are the ones that drive fundraising. And really during COVID, we've seen that those groups that are so heavily reliant upon events are scrambling. And those groups that have kind of a wide breadth of offerings for their constituents and prospects and donors are the ones that are thriving. And I'll get to that a little bit later. The second myth is the life expectancy of a staff member. So I think that this actually isn't even unique to fundraising. You aren't going to see anyone getting the golden watch after 35 years of service anymore. That just doesn't happen. They say that when a university student graduates, they're going to go through 9 careers in their life, not 9 jobs, 9 careers. So I think just managing expectations is a huge, huge issue. You know, for those of us that are in the fundraising world, we tend not to do it for the oodles of money that are thrown at us as salary, right? We could probably make a lot more money in sales somewhere else. We're doing it for some sort of altruistic reasons. So whenever that doesn't jive anymore, and whenever there's some sort of friction, you see a lot of movement. And I think that the average tenure of a staff member is in between 18 and 36 months. So it's incumbent upon us as fundraisers to help the boards and bosses manage those expectations. So if you're expecting that folks are going to be there for 10, 15, 20 years, you have some big problems. If you're going there for 18 to 36 months and you get 4 years out of someone, you're doing pretty good. So it's all about managing those expectations. When it comes to that, a lot of it is boards and bosses don't necessarily like fundraising. And they have no idea how to supervise fundraisers because they don't want to actually go out and fundraise themselves. They've hired someone to do that. So one of my good friends, Jason Lewis, who wrote a great book, The War for Fundraising Talent, talks about key performance indicators. And his are 100% non-financial. And it's really interesting thing. So, you know, how many visits did you go on? How many second gifts did you ask for that were there? All of these kind of things, those are things that you can certainly be doing metrics with. And if you aren't doing the right activity, you're never going to get the right results on the back end of it. So it need not be you have to bring in X millions of dollars. If the activity is there, then the money is going to definitely come out of there. Another myth. Mr. X has lots of money. He'll give it to us. And that is just horrible. If that was actually the case, then all of us could just sit there and go home and we'll just write really nice letters to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and cash the checks as soon as we possibly can. It's really not. So I talk about in my book, there's four C's, what makes someone a good prospect. And there's commitment, contact, capacity, and charitable by nature. So capacity is not the number one driver. Commitment is the number one driver. So where this really helps with bequests is you're much more likely to get a bequest out of someone who's been a consistent donor. It need not be a huge donor. You know, they may give your organization $500 a year or be a direct mail donor for 20 years. You're much more likely to get a bequest out of that individual than you are an individual who gives you a one-time gift of $1 million. So just let that sink in for a bit. It's not the capacity that drives it. It's the commitment that drives it. So, you know, charitable by nature is also something that you need to know. And I have found when we were at the Ottawa Hospital, we did a focus group, and it was through a glass wall and, you know, one-way mirrors and the whole nine yards. It's very cool to be part of. And we interviewed a whole bunch of direct mail donors with kind of some thoughts about bequests. And we realized a couple of things. Just like direct mail, those that support direct mail, if they support one organization, they're likely supporting at least 10. And same with bequests. So if someone has left a provision in their estate for a charity, odds are better than not they've left more than one. So I found that it's a much better use of your time to go and see if you can become one of the many than to try to convince someone of the merit of leaving a charitable bequest to begin with. And there are some exceptionally wealthy folks that I've come across in the last 20 years here in Ottawa who don't believe in leaving a bequest for the for a charity. They'll support it hugely while they're alive. And their theory is, I'm going to give it to my kids. And if they want to do it, then that's up to them. But I'm not leaving a bequest in my for charity in my estate plans. So you've got to take a look. They're charitable by nature during their life, but they're pretty big on not doing a bequest. I think all of us also have to realize, what do we do with these bequests? I've been to some organizations where it just gets thrown into, you know, the communal pot. I've seen other organizations that say every bequest will be endowed regardless of size. And endowment is a tough thing to do, especially with the economy right now. It's a real tough thing to go and say to a donor, take $1 million from your bank account that's been sitting there and let it sit in our bank account. Because odds are better than not, the donor who had that million is growing it much better than the foundation is, because their risk tolerance is much higher. Another thing, so another myth, sales is like fundraising, and fundraising is like sales, right? There are great similarities, and there are some best practices that you can certainly learn from on that. But the reality is that, you know, your car breaks down, you need a car, whether it's a Ford or a Honda or a Chevy or a Porsche, whatever it is, you need your car. No one needs to give to charity other than those that tie, and they're a whole other separate kettle of fish. So when it comes to philanthropy, it's not sales. People have often said philanthropy is like sales with a heart. And they might be on the right path a little bit, but there's certainly some measurables that are there. You know, there are some best practices that are out there. And, you know, certainly asking for a gift or asking to close the sale, you know, and there's a skill set that needs to be done. But it's a much more of a soft sell. And especially as fundraisers, we create a false timeline, and we create that urgency. So, you know, your car breaks in, you need a new car, right? Or your lease is up, or, you know, whatever, it's a, you know, 1992 jalopy and you need to get rid of it before, you know, Drive Clean comes and slaps a sticker on it. But no one needs to give to charity, and no one needs to give to charity today more than tomorrow. And you'll read actually in my book that one of my biggest pet peeves are those organizations that send those emails in December that says, oh, the end of the year is coming, you have to make your donation now. Really? You won't accept my donation in January? It makes no sense to me. I don't need a charity to come and tell me when the end of the year is. I know when it is. And no one says, well, what's the impact? Why do you need it by the end of the year? And maybe there's a government grant. Maybe there's some matching money. Maybe they have to bring in a certain amount because the project has to start January 1st, whatever it is. So I think that that's a little bit the miss. And the other one that I thought was most donors are businesses was another huge myth. Oh, you must deal with businesses all the time. I separate businesses into kind of two different categories. One is like a corporate business, like a bank, where there's really a committee. They've decided that they're going to give away X amount in philanthropy. I don't really count a family business as a business, even the ones that are really, really big. And here in Ottawa, we have a lot of big family businesses. I don't count them as family businesses. That just may be how the donors are flowing their donation to you, but that's more of a tax strategy. You're still asking those people. They aren't going to a committee. They're just deciding it, and they may funnel it through the business, and they may not funnel it through the business. So again, you know, I've seen reports that say, you know, 80 to 90% are individuals. Then you have corporations, foundations, and bequests. Well, bequests by definition are individuals because you can't have a bequest from a corporation or a foundation. And then foundations are, let's say, half individual and half corporate. So the reality is the majority of fundraising is all from the individuals. So those are five of the big myths. The other five, you guys are going to have to buy the book and see what it is.
Go ahead, Jack. Well, I was looking for, my head is reeling, and so I'm sure the folks on our call are reeling too. I had an idea, so I want to throw something at you, Jack.
Sure.
What if we took each of these ones in a sequence, and we could sort of group think, or people could ask questions on each one? Would that be okay?
Sounds like a plan to me.
Okay, so there was you got us going on this whole planned giving thing. There were some suggestions for other names in the chat. So we have some votes for strategic giving or legacy giving. What do you think about those titles? And I want to add a second part. How do you talk about planned giving in front of the donor? Because that's another part of that conversation about naming.
Great, great questions. Number one, I hate titles. I loathe them. If I was given my druthers whenever I was working for an organization, I would just have my name on the business card, period.
Okay.
I hate titles because it's all internal jargon. To this day, I have no idea what the difference between a manager, coordinator, director, senior director. I have no idea what the hell that means. And then they sometimes throw in the words development, and which is great in the fundraising world, but everyone else thinks you're in construction. So, you know, it's internal jargon. And I think those titles are just weird. But as far as talking to donors, one of the things that I experienced when I was kind of behind that glass wall was anyone usually under the age of about 60, 65 doesn't want to talk about bequests at all. They don't want to do it. It's not until they start kind of seeing some of their peers passing on that they want to establish it. The reality is the majority of donors don't have wills. I remember when I was at the Ottawa Hospital, the head of our planned giving, I had no choice on that, planned giving committee was a lawyer at Gowling's. And she told me that 2/3 of the lawyers at Gowling's do not have wills. Talk about something like the emperor has no clothes, right? It's absolutely bizarre. So most people just don't do it. And it's really, really a strange thing. But I think talking about it, it's more than a, you know, an initial conversation, right? It's much more of a long game. And I think that as fundraisers, and there's a lot of pressure from boards and bosses to get that money, that quick money in all the time. And Jason Lewis kind of talks about three lanes of fundraising. And the first lane is kind of arm's length fundraising, the direct mail, the events, where you really don't have to deal with people very much. You can kind of send out a mass whatever, and there's going to be a whole bunch of money coming in. That's great. Lane three is kind of the capital campaigns, where you go to those folks and you get, you know, some really big dollars and you foster those relationships. Where that kind of middle lane is that very few folks are actually fostering are those kind of mid-range donors, right? We all have stewardship plans for your Uber donors, and you may have stewardship plans for your new donors, but very few folks have stewardship plans for the person who's giving $500 to $5,000.
So it's just, yeah. So I could jump in with the first thing that comes to mind is the earlier part of our conversation where we were saying that lots of fundraisers don't actually like asking for money. So
yes,
at the risk of using jargon, we're talking about a mid-level giving program there, Jack.
Yeah.
Right. And tell me more about what that might look like that second lane in a shop that you would work in.
So it's very funny. For those of you who have worked with me and have seen me since I've done, I went to a conference that Charles Bronfman puts on every year with the 2164 organization, which are focused on folks in between the ages of 21 and 64 who are going to be inheriting a large sum of wealth. Yeah. And he has what he calls value cards. And there's no right or wrong answer. There's about 25 different cards that are there. And, you know, something like equity, being fair and free from bias, or you go to leadership, motivating others to work toward achieving a common purpose. I've done this exercise with donors where you have the 25 cards. And I said, pick your top three motivators as to why you give and pick your bottom three. And you'll see kind of what resonates with some folks. You know, my favorite are the boards and the donors who say, oh, I would never want a naming opportunity for me. But for other people, you got to make sure you have A, B, C, and D. Of course, they want it for themselves, right? But what are you going to do? So I think it's those discussions. And what kind of legacy do you want to leave? Talking about, you know, in Canada, we're still polite as a group. You know, what were the money discussions around the table? Did your parents donate? Did you know what your parents donated to? And how did that affect you? And, you know, why was that important to them? Did they volunteer, right? Because obviously volunteers tend to donate a lot more than non-volunteers. By the way, those that go to religious organizations, churches, synagogues, mosques, whatever, they tend to donate more. Yeah. And statistically, they also tend to live longer.
Wow.
Go figure, right?
Go figure. So yeah. I can highly recommend the 2164. I have those cards, Jack.
Yeah.
And I brought, so you can Google that if you want. It's a foundation of the States and you can order them. I brought them on a trip to Mexico with my family.
Right.
And that became the conversation over mojitos by the beach. And Jack, I learned this whole other side about my mother in particular that I had no idea about. We had a wonderful time talking about this. So I love that you're bringing those to your donors. I love the conversations you're having. I want to shift. I want to check in with folks on the chat. We had a comment from Maury about how COVID has really changed the way people are approaching planned giving. And some of those folks, those mea culpas that haven't had wills are coming around to their senses. I was speaking to someone at Dalhousie who's in their planned giving program. And she said they've had an unprecedented number of people self-identifying at age 40, and they think it's tied to these online will programs that people are doing. So just wanted to share that. Questions about event number one, or myth number one, which was that events raise tons of money. Did anybody have any questions? You also talked nicely, eloquently about messaging to boards, events versus a longer term play. So feel free to put your questions in the chat around myth number one. Can I just say thank you for saying you hate events? Because I feel disloyal when I say that.
Yes. The problem with, you know, events, you know, again, I grew up in London, Ontario. There was a home lottery. Those events, you know, like CHEO does and some of the other ones. I think it was the Monsignor Feeney Foundation, you know, a Catholic seminary that was there. Mm-hmm. And the way the laws work is once you sell one ticket, you're obliged to do the whole lottery. And they lost about $400,000. So the problem with an event is you can lose money on an event. And so many boards and bosses actually will take an event and say, oh, you know what? We had a golf tournament. It grossed $100,000. We netted $50,000. And isn't that great? I double net things. I say, okay, now I'm going to appropriate staff time to it. Yep. And whatever number you want to come up with. So if it mm-hmm. took someone $25,000 worth, well, now you've made $25,000. It's still mm-hmm. respectable. But what happens if that number becomes negative? Yeah. Now what do you do? Yeah. So, you know, many times boards and bosses value staff time at zero. Uh-huh. And it's not.
Yeah, I always say that your most valuable asset is your people, and your responsibility, at least as a head of shop, is how to allocate that stuff. So I had one recently where one of my clients is talking about doing, it's a lottery or a car rally or one of those suckers, because they think that'll be easy, right? Because $100 ticket's way easier than asking for a $100,000 gift. And one of the challenges I think people have is, you know, you get sucked into the vortex, the event vortex. Even if you disagree with it at the senior leadership level, those are courageous conversations, Jack, to say to your board chair, who's your boss, and say things like, so I am delighted you're going to run this raffle as a third party event, right? Clarity on language. Any other advice for people about how you draw that line? I love your ROI. That's a great thing. Anything else?
Yeah. So, you know, I think ROI is a huge thing. And I think that when it comes to events, you know, if you have a dinner, the first thing you do is you ask your board chair, well, how many tables are you going to sell? Right. So, and that usually tends to kind of quiet them up pretty quickly. Yeah. That's there.
Yeah. Love that. So let's move on to, I'm watching the chat. I'll get back to it here. Betty Ann says, our experience as well, Jennifer, with donor motivation program is that 60% of the donors participating in our presentation are planning up. Sorry, I'm lost. Are planning updating their estate plan. So there you go. We have another argument about wills being updated. Number two, myth number two, and I welcome your chats and on the questions in the chat. Life expectancy of a staff member. So this made me chuckle because I thought you meant like staff members were going to die. That was not your intention.
No.
I love your expectation setting. They're not supposed to give their life away when they join the Ottawa Jewish Federation as a staff member. Tell me more.
For that one, they are. yeah. You know what? I think that it's, I've been blessed in the mm-hmm. fact that I am someone, when I hire staff, I spend a lot of time on the hiring process. Because to bring a staff member in and onboard them and all these things, it's a big investment from a supervisor, right? So just to plug a hole in, you know, if you have a gut feeling this isn't going to work, leave the position vacant and perhaps, you know, repost it in a month or two and get a different crowd rather than knowingly hire a warm body where you know it's not going to work.
Wow. That takes courage and I admire you. I would love to see in the chat, how long have people been at their shops? I see a 5 years from Jennifer Lorimer. I'd love to hear where other people, how long you've been at your shop. Any advice about the hiring process, Jack? I know that's very personal, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on hiring great people.
Yeah, I always give homework assignments. So, you know, if I was hiring, I've hired an events person before and I had them kind of create an event plan for me. I've had a direct mail person and I've had them create a direct mail letter for me. And, you know, part of it is to actually kind of see what they can do, because so many times people will put on their resumes or CVs, oh, I raised millions of dollars. And you really realize that it wasn't them that raised it. They were part of the team that raised it, but they actually weren't responsible for raising it themselves. Mm-hmm. So this kind of separates the men from the boys, if I can say that.
Yeah.
And to kind of, you know, see what's going on there. So again, it's that expectation, you know, I think, and to keep staff there, staff aren't staying on for the millions of dollars we're paying, right? So how is it that the staff member themselves are growing? Is there enrichment that you can send them to? Is there personal enrichment? You know, is there sending them to a writing course? Is that what they're interested in? That will actually make you a better shop if you have a stronger writer, right? Or financial literacy or whatever it may be. There are certain things that just make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I love it. So the other thing I see a lot of is we have a very shallow talent pool for great people. I work with folks that are on Cape Breton Island, for example. It's even shallower if it's possible. Jack, do you hire? This is a tough one. Do you hire for potential? Do you hire for skills? How do you think about that?
I hire for attitude over aptitude every single day. You can teach someone the skills. I can't teach someone to be a good person. I can't teach someone to be a good listener. I can't teach someone to be empathetic. I can certainly teach them about, you know, a charitable remainder trust or, you know, flow through shares.
Yeah.
But that's a technical skill.
Love it. Love it. Okay. I got two great questions. Yeah. Thank you. I wholeheartedly agree with that. Two questions here. I think it was Elaine that said, for direct mail, do we do email or posted mail? What's your preference?
Interesting. So I would take a look at your demographics. And your demographics tend to be, you know, direct mail is always kind of this weird thing to me. I would never in a million years donate to direct mail because I'm not their target audience.
Right.
For the most part, they tend to be older folks. Mm-hmm. And I can remember in former lives going to these donors' homes and they would have every piece of direct mail that we ever sent them in a pile and it's highlighted with notes in the margins, the whole nine yards. They love that. So my theory would be if you actually are emailing them, odds are better than not, they're printing it out. So you want to actually have a, you know, when it comes to the direct mail, you want to have both options. And I would not recommend just emailing your direct mail package.
Right.
That's really not what you want. You want to have something specific for your electronic audience and something specific for your snail mail audience.
Love it. Love it. And we, you know, that cross-platform marketing, that idea of, I mean, we could do a whole webinar on that, but I love that you're thinking about the, what's the word, the vehicle, right, Jack? How it comes to your mailbox, subject lines, adjusting the campaign to fit for an inbox versus a snail mail. And aside, I've often done the same thing where I go and pick up a check from a donor and they're writing the check in some other charity's pen, right? Like branded pen. Because you're right, they're giving to 7 to 10 other organizations. And who are we to call them our donors? I don't know how you feel about that, Jack, but they're not our donors.
100%. Here's a little tip that I actually found really neat. I saw it last couple of weeks online somewhere that there was a shop somewhere in the States that the direct mail person actually hand wrote all of the, she did it with a test case, I think of like 100. And she took essentially the direct mail letter and hand wrote it and sent it to those 100 people. And I think she said she got 70 out of the 100, gave a donation. Yeah. 70.
Yeah.
Like that's unbelievable. Yeah. Now that's a heck of a lot of writing and I certainly, no one will be able to read my writing. There's a reason why computers were invented. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, the more personal you can do it, the better off you are. And, you know, the world has gotten really easy with those like auto pens. And, you know, whenever I see something signed, I wet my thumb and I go like that and to see if it smudges or not, right? For those of you who know me, green is my favorite color. I lived in the States for a couple of years, color of money, right? And I write always in green pen. So when there were donor thank you letters or whatever it is, I'd write, I called them little love notes at the bottom, a little personalization, but it was always in green ink.
Yeah.
And that way they kind of knew, hey, there was someone who actually looked at it. So the more personal you can make this, the better off we're all going to be.
Oh, Oh, so can we just like quote that? Somebody tweet that on Twitter. That idea that that direct mail piece was touched by someone with love. Jen Love, the shop out of Toronto, has a thing called the, what's tombon? What's tombon in English, guys? What are those things called? Paperclip, the paperclip test. That when you receive someone from someone, if it has a paperclip on it, you knew that somebody touched it. So whether it's writing the address in person, whether it's a little note inside, clipping a photo, a real person touched it. And Jack, I would challenge that that's why we got 70 out of 100 was because they knew someone asked, someone personally mm-hmm. asked.
Yeah.
Okay, so this isn't on the list, but this is such an interesting topic for me. Why do you think people go into fundraising even though they don't like asking for money?
Great question. Because I think they want to do good. And they want to be associated with someone that somewhere that does good. You know, I spent a pile of time at the Ottawa Hospital, and I always felt like I was part of a machine that was saving lives. Mm-hmm. And so many of us are in charities where you're saving lives, you know, whether it, you know, or providing dignity. Like what we're doing is a noble, noble cause. And one of my pet peeves is people say, oh, you're out begging for money. I'm like, I don't beg for money. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. some of the biggest gifts I've ever received, I didn't ask for. So, you know, that's kind of par for the course as well. It's quite noble. And I think that's why so many of us are in there. But at the end of the day, we're still Canadian and we're still polite. And we still think that it's like some sort of a taboo subject to talk about money. Mm-hmm. You know, in Europe, people disclose their salaries left, right, and center, right? Mm-hmm. Here we have no problem telling people what we paid for a house, or you can look it up on MLS, or what we paid for a car. But there's no way that you'll ever tell your next door neighbor what you earn. It's kind of one of those taboo subjects. So fundraising is, we just have to remember, we're a means to an end. We're a tool. In an ideal world, you'd wake up in the morning and there'd be a pile of cash sitting there for your charity and you wouldn't have to go and ask for it.
Sure.
But you gotta, if you want it, you have to ask for a gift.
Mm-hmm. And or get coached by someone who knows how to do it and work to change some of those attitudes. I call it the fundraiser money dance, right? Money is important. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's right. not. I want to pick up on this chat conversation. There's a bunch of people. I think it's a great comment. Asking you to speak a little bit to performance measurements for fundraisers. You mentioned Jason Lewis and metrics that are not numerical related. Tell us more, because people want to make sure they can remunerate or appreciate or performance review their fundraisers.
Great question. So every prospect manager or fundraiser has a certain number of prospects or donors that are appointed to them. And they're all kind of in different phases, right? If you're a relationship manager, some you're going to be in the cultivation phase, some you're going to be in the ask phase, some you're going to be in the stewardship phase. By the way, you don't steward a donor, you steward a gift.
Nice.
You want to take a look at the pipeline. So how many of your folks are in each of those? And really, you know, you can almost do the law of thirds. There should be a third of them that are prospects, a third of them that are donors, and a third of them that are in the kind of stewardship phase at any given time. And that's dynamic. And what's great is so many databases track these kind of things for you. So if you set it up to begin with, you can do a snapshot. You know, when I was at the Y, we had, as a manager, I was able to kind of look and see where my team was, how many of their folks were in what phase. And it works quite well. You know, you want to take a look at some of the other things, you know, how many are on your first visits versus subsequent visits, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. many times you don't ask for a gift on the first date, right? Mm-hmm. You don't propose on the first date. Mm-hmm. So you want to see, well, how many second or third visits are there? How many times do you visit with an ask, and how many times do you visit without an ask? And you want to figure out what that ratio is, right? So if it's, you know, if you think about it, if you're doing, 10 visits and you're only asking one out of every 10, you're having a problem actually getting the words out of your mouth. If you're the exact opposite, you're like a bull in a china shop, right? So you have to somehow figure out that there's a happy medium in there. And, you know, you want to take a look at what those assigned lists are and, you know, make sure that there's a 2-week, you know, turnaround so that people aren't just sitting with that list. You know, many people in our shops, there's that mentality, especially in the bigger shops, you can't touch Joe Blow. He's my donor. And what are you doing with Joblo? Nothing. I have plans. So 6 months later comes and you see, okay, what have you done with Joblo? Nothing. But you can't touch him. He's my donor. Well, that makes no sense at all, right?
Yeah.
And I think we have to stop saying it's my donor. Mm-hmm. It's the organization's donor. Mm-hmm. And there are times that I said in a former life to one of my colleagues, I can't get past this spot with the donor for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Will you take this one on?
Yeah.
And she was able to move the needle. Great, good on her. And that's the way, you know, it should be.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to kind of check your ego at the door and say, what's in the best interest of the donor?
Yeah. Yeah. So many wonderful takeaways. I hope you guys were making notes on that. And what I love about the way you've described it is depending on where you're at in your major gifts program, you might change your goals. So you might want to have a metric, thinking of performance review, of we want 60 new conversations, brand new, because maybe you're building a pipeline. But I like that a third. That gives you a nice healthy churn. I know there's some research coming out of the States, and I'd love your thoughts on this around significantly dropping prospect list sizes for major guest folks, particularly if we're talking advancement and hospitals and big shops, with the premise that we really can't manage, full-time major guest people can't manage much more than 50 or 60 active files. Now, I do also work with small shops, and that's challenging for them because if you add up those small shop gifts of 60, it doesn't hit the number we need at a major gifts. Do you have some thoughts or some anecdotes about what you've seen of the sweet spot?
Yeah. You know what? It is interesting. And I think they say that, you know, you should be somewhere around 75 to 100 is kind of that sweet spot that many have said.
Yeah.
But what I used to kind of deal with my teams were, who are your top 20? I would actually shrink it way down. So it's a manageable number. And then kind of every quarter, we would take a look and say, okay, that 20 is dynamic, right? So one or two may drop off and say, you know what? These really aren't high priority at the moment, but these other two are. So, you know, it's kind of looking at the 20 and you should be having some sort of a strategy as to how to move those moves management, get those folks moving from one to the other. And sending someone a birthday card is not moves management.
Thank you. Amen. Or
right?
Hallelujah, so, or whatever word it is that works for you.
Yeah. And, you know, you also want to be able to bring in other people. And I think that's also, you know, so many of our organizations, especially the small ones, are so wrapped up on relationships with, you know, very few people that if one of them leaves, they're scrambling because no one knows Mrs. Smith. Mm-hmm. You know, Bob had a relationship with her and Bob's gone now.
Yeah.
So it's not great for the organization. So it need not be a fundraiser, but there needs to be someone, whether it's a board member or a staff member or a program person, someone needs to kind of be with you as well. And it also lends credibility to what it is you do.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Love it. So folks in the chat, please feel free to ask your questions. I'm mindful of the time. We're going to be finishing up in about 15 minutes. We had the myth, Mr. X has lots of money. We had the myth, sales is like fundraising. And I love this. Most donors are businesses, which is so not true. I mean, the first thing they do is let's go knock on Main Street, whatever, insert name of town here, right? Because they have lots of money.
And I would suggest that in this post-COVID era, most corporations are going to be cutting and slashing, if they actually survive, their philanthropic budgets, right? So.
Yeah. So I'm going to bring you back to, because I have a about this major gifts portfolio thing. I want to go somewhere specific. You strike me as doesn't he strike you guys as a smooth strategic talker? Like, you know, you could bring him into your board and he'd be able to, you know, manage any situation. So Jack, here's the scenario. You got a CEO who's in charge of too many major gift relationships and can't get to them and won't let them go. And meanwhile, there's a whole pool of prospects that aren't getting accessed up there. Any advice for the fundraiser in that shop to how to smoothly bring about transition and change there?
So are you talking about like a foundation, like a hospital foundation, where it's the CEO of the hospital foundation versus the CEO of the hospital?
CEO of the hospital foundation, to correct.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And so I guess my theory is the untapped potential of not moving those major gifts folks through a moves management, hate that word, sorry, through a relationship building exercise, where you're trying to access them. It's hoarding. It's really hoarding. They don't mean it. They mean it in the best of ways.
Right.
Any advice for how we access those prospects?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. I think they say that a CEO should spend a third of their time in the fundraising. That's it. Now, it need not be specifically asking for money. You know, they can be doing stewardship. They can do thank you calls. They can do tours. They can do whatever it is. But they have bigger fish to fry and they have a board to answer to, right? So I would say that most CEOs are more than happy to kind of give it up. Where there's a little bit of resistance, you know, I think it's the same. I'm pretty open and transparent. The folks that work with me, I encourage folks to kind of question and question authority. And, you know, as long as it's done in a respectful way, there's no problem with that. You know, say, hey, listen, you haven't moved on Mrs. Jones in 6 months. You know, I saw her at a Red Blacks game and, you know, I'd love to be able to kind of follow up. Can we maybe work on this together? Might be a great start. And then when they say, okay, now you can move it on to you. I think so many times CEOs, and it happens in the for-profit world as well, they'll have great salespeople, but when it comes down to closing the deal, they have to be there so they can say they're the ones that closed it.
Yeah.
And really, who cares?
Yeah.
One of my happiest moments was in a former life where some of my team raised a huge amount of money. And you know what? It looks great on everyone and it looks great on me for hiring such smart people and such capable people to go out and do that. So don't stand in their way. Let them shine.
Oh, beautiful. Let them shine. Mitch is going to do a draw for the book right now, but there's still time for a couple more questions burning questions from the group. But Mitch, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Thank you. So I think the fairest way to do this is I'm going to ask Jack to choose a number between 1 and 40, and I'm going to see who on the list matches up to that number. And the only person who can't win right now is Megan, because she already got one. So we'll see if he chooses a different number.
I'd go with number 18, which is the Hebrew for chai, like lechayim.
Okay, so 18 is Jennifer Lorimer from United Way. I think she's here, so she's eligible. Yes. So
yeah.
Jennifer will be the winner, and we'll arrange to get it to her afterwards. Thank you, guys.
Congratulations, back to Jennifer. Wonderful. Okay, cool. So before we get into the last final questions, Selva, you have some things that you'd like to share with us about willpower and what's going on and how Ottawa Chapter is supporting it. Do you want to take the stage?
Thank you, Jenny. And thanks so much, Jack. This has been great. So hi, everyone. I'm Selva, and I'm the Willpower Chair for CAGP Ottawa Chapter. And I just wanted to let you know to please, if you could save the date on your calendars. We're looking to have a presentation on March 23rd around Willpower. We'll be joined by Lori Fox, which is the campaign director. She'll be there to answer any questions and tell you a little more about the campaign. And for those of you who haven't heard about Willpower before, essentially it is the reinvention of CAGP's Leave a Legacy. And it was modeled on the Remember a Charity in Your Will campaign from the UK. So it launched in September in areas of Ontario, and it did quite well. So it's launching in the rest of Canada this spring, including Ottawa. So we can't wait to tell you more about it. So please save the date and look out for the invitation for March 23rd. We hope to see you there.
Fantastic. Thanks, Selva. Wonderful. Good stuff. Okay. So I just went back to the chat because, you know, we want to pack in as much information and questions and community building here. Elaine has a question, Jack. And Elaine, I might get you to go on the mic and explain it. It says, what is your feeling about board members and them making a bequest or open a fund? Do you want to explain that, Elaine?
Sure. Thanks, everybody. I'm actually here from West Vancouver, so it's nice to kind of make a connection across the country. I work for a foundation, and we talk about bequests, and we talk about planned gifts, and we talk about legacy giving. And I would say on average, less than a third of our board actually have left a bequest or opened a fund. So I'm relatively new to this business. I came out of corporate life, and so I don't know if that's a good number or if that's, you know, like, so I'm looking for some input.
Sure.
Great question. I would actually say that as far as opening a fund, a lot of that depends on the size of the minimum requirement to open up a fund. I've been at places where it's $1,000 as a minimum. I've been in other places where it's $100,000 as a minimum. Yeah. So, you know, again, it's just kind of, it's almost like the same question. Should everyone on the board be donors? Yes. You know, we qualify it with, you know, it should be a meaningful gift is usually what I say. So, mm-hmm. you know, where what might be $500 for one person might be $50,000 for the other person. But as far as a bequest goes, I think that that's totally doable. You know, most folks, at least the concept of a bequest, you know, most folks wait until big life circumstances, you know, a death in the family or kids get married or grandkids to actually change their will. But, you know, I used to talk to families about leaving 1%. You know, before it was Imagine Canada, it was the Canadian Center for Philanthropy. And they said if everyone gave 1% of their worth to charity, you wouldn't need charities, right? So whether you were the Bill Gates or whether you were the guy that was, you know, struggling on the streets, if everyone gave 1%, you're fine. So the way I figured it is, if you left 1% of your estate to charity, the tax treatment, roughly speaking, is half of it's going to go back to the estate. So you tell me what family can't live on 99.5% of the estate and how they're going to fight you on that. Now, again, I preface it by saying, as I said earlier, those that leave a bequest in their will tend to leave it to numerous charities. It's rare that you just see one sole charity as the beneficiary. So I would caution you and say, I'd work with the folks that actually believe in leaving a bequest to charities. But you know, with a board, one of the big things is that you got to walk the walk. The reality is that a bequest is totally revocable. So they could say today, yeah, I'm going to leave something. And in theory, when they're off the board, they could go and have it changed and have it removed. My guess is they wouldn't, but in theory they could.
Thank you. Great questions. Somebody was asking, how can we get your book, Jack?
On Amazon, the source of everything. So yeah, amazon.ca, com, whatever you want to have your little suffix as.
Wonderful, wonderful. You were saying, am I allowed to say this, that the process of writing the book was painful? The outcome was wonderful, but...
Yeah, the process is horribly painful. I am not a writer. So that's why, you know, when I tend to hire folks, I tend to hire folks that are complimentary to me. I don't need another carbon copy of me. That would be spooky. What I need are the folks that excel in the areas I don't. And written word is one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting. I think we were also talking about your willpower days coming up. Mm-hmm. And one of my kind of pet peeves when it comes to things is so many of us focus on how to give a bequest and forget about that. Focus on why. Because if you haven't got the question of why they should have a bequest, the how really doesn't matter. So many of us, you know, get all caught up on how to do a charitable remainder trust or what the wording is. Who cares? There's professionals for that. Yeah. What you need to know is how to inspire someone and why they should want to leave a bequest in the first place.
Yeah. I'm struck by your energy, Jack. You have such wonderful...
Yeah.
Maybe to send us off on our merry way here today, I'll pass it over to Mitch to close us out. I hope I haven't forgotten anything. Jack, thank you so much for your words of wisdom.
My pleasure.
Your directness, I think all of us on the call would agree, is really refreshing. I feel very inspired to go and ask for what I want and invite conversations that matter to me. I'm so glad that we had a chance to chat with you here. Mitch, over to you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jenny. So for starters, just before I thank Jack, I want to thank Jenny, who always does a great job as the Oprah of our chapter. You know, as per usual, she was able to get a introvert like Jack to open up a little bit, you know, and share his thoughts. I know for those of you who know Jack are having a good laugh. I normally wouldn't have this in the middle of the day, but cheers to Jack. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with everyone today. Certainly, personally, you've helped to mentor me in my early career in fundraising, and always very open and challenging with the things you shared with me. And the book has been great, and I enjoy having to read it. And I hope everyone who want a copy will enjoy it as much as I have. And those of you who are going to go online, I'm sure today to get one, will enjoy it as well. So thank you everyone for being here. Enjoy your day and continue to make a positive difference for the organizations you represent.
L'chaim.
L'chaim, everybody. Thank you.